From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Poet Natasha Trethewey writes of history, race, and of how intricately intertwined memory and forgetting always are. She won the 2007 Pulitzer Prize in Poetry for Native Guard, a collection of poems inspired by a largely forgotten regiment of black soldiers who fought for the Union in the Civil War, guarded Confederate prisoners on an island off the Gulf Coast. She's meditated on the long, hard tale of Hurricane Katrina, glossed over by a narrative of recovery and reconstruction, and on her own background as a mixed-race Southerner who has made poetry of tragedy and hope. This hour on Point, the next Poet Laureate of the United States, Natasha Trethewey. You can join the conversation, What Do You Need from a Poet Laureate These Days? From Natasha Trethewey. You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Natasha Trethewey joins us now from Atlanta. She's a professor of English and creative writing at Emory University there, author of three poetry collections, Native Guard, Belox, Ophelia, and Domestic Work. She's also author of the nonfiction Beyond Katrina, a meditation on the Mississippi Gulf Coast. Her fourth poetry collection out this fall is Thrall. Last week, she was named the next U.S. Poet Laureate. She'll formally take up her duties this fall. Natasha Trethewey, welcome to the show. Thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on the program.
You've written a lot of poetry. You've won a lot of awards. You've read a lot of poetry. What's it mean to be Poet Laureate these days?
Well, that's a hard question. It means, I think, to me, both a great honor, but also a great deal of responsibility.
To do what?
To promote poetry across the nation and to bring it to the widest possible audience.
When you think about where our country is right now, where we are as individuals, people, that's a great big mural. But what's the role of poetry now? What can it do for us in the moment we're in, maybe even the fix we're in?
Well, you know, I think that poetry is one of those things that people turn to in really difficult times. We turn to it when we think that there's no way to say what must be said. Poetry is the thing that for us can, in many ways, get us closer to speaking the unspeakable. I certainly turn to it for those reasons. Lots of people turn to it for those reasons after the tragedy of 9/11, people who might not have read or written poetry before. And so I think it does still have a role in our lives because it always has the possibility to celebrate our joys with us, but to also mourn with us our losses.
Do you think it's more important in a time like we're in now? Is there a steady state of importance of poetry? Do you have a sense of people turning more to it these days? You're going to be the one on the hood ornament there.
Well, that's right. You know, I think that probably, you know, in the general public, as much as I'd like to think that we turn to poetry all the time, perhaps we don't always turn to it, that there are certain kinds of catalysts that make us go to it more. I'm reminded of the lines from a poem by William Carlos Williams, "You can't get the news from poetry, mm-hmm. but men die miserably every day for lack of what is found there." So there's something always in poetry for us if we turn to it, because it is a kind of prayer, but we don't always turn to it. I'd like to see if I can get us to turn to it a little bit more.
Help us understand your story. You've got a poem from half a dozen years ago, Miscegenation, from your collection, Native Guard, that helps us understand something about you, your biography, Natasha. Would you read from it?
That's right. You know, I think it helps to explain my biography in some ways, but also the biography of a nation mm-hmm. in many ways as well, because it's a poem that's not only about custom and my experience of being biracial in the South, but it's also about history. It's about the laws that were in effect not only in my home state of Mississippi, but across the country. Mm-hmm. It's called Miscegenation. In 1965, my parents broke two laws of Mississippi. They went to Ohio to marry, returned to Mississippi. They crossed the river into Cincinnati, a city whose name begins with a sound like sin, the sound of wrong, miss in Mississippi. A year later, they moved to Canada, followed a route the same as slaves, the train slicing the white glaze of winter, leaving Mississippi. Faulkner's Joe Christmas was born in winter, like Jesus, given his name for the day he was left at the orphanage, his race unknown, in Mississippi. My father was reading War and Peace when he gave me my name. I was born near Easter, 1966, in Mississippi. When I turned 33, my father said, "It's your Jesus year. You're the same age he was when he died. It was spring, the hills green in Mississippi." I know more than Joe Christmas did. Natasha is a Russian name, though I'm not. It means Christmas child, even in Mississippi.
Even in Mississippi. Natasha Trethewey, newly named Poet Laureate of the United States. She'll take up those duties this fall. And right there in her poem, Miscegenation, you get to know a lot about her. And as she says, maybe a lot about us. Joe Christmas from Faulkner's Light in August, right in there, with the white mother and a father of who knew what exactly ancestry. Who were, are your mom and dad, Natasha?
My father, who is still living, is a professor of English, Eric Trethewey, at Hollins University. He also teaches creative writing there in the program. My mother, born Gwendolyn Ann Turnbow, was a social worker in the state of Georgia.
The white parent, she, the African-American parent, how did they meet? Why did they take that risk to marry when it was still hard?
Well, you know, it's a lovely, happy accident the way that they met. My parents met at Kentucky State College, which is now Kentucky State University. But Kentucky State was one of the historically all-black colleges and universities. And my mother transferred there from Bluffton University in her sophomore year. My father got there. He was coming from Canada. And before coming to the United States, got out a guide to American colleges and universities to find one that he could afford and that might give him a track scholarship. And so we chose Kentucky State without realizing it was a black college and ended up there. And I always love the story that my mother told me about the first time they actually met. It was when the Righteous Brothers had come out with that song, "You Lost That Love and Feeling."
Yeah, oh, sure.
And all the women in my mother's dorm gathered around the TV because I think that there was a variety show and the Righteous Brothers were going to appear. And they were convinced that these men with these soulful voices had to be black. And when they came on and they weren't, my mother says my father jogged by the window at the same moment, and it was love at first sight.
A little musical backdrop, and the Canadian at Kentucky State who kind of stumbled into a whole life there.
That's right.
Where's that? How's that left you thinking about this particular president of the United States that has led our country for these last, three and a half years now? Three and a half? I mean, you share that mixed race background with him. Did you, look for your identity across that spectrum? Did you have to actively nail it down, as we learn he did from his biography?
You know, I think in many ways I did. I think it's not necessarily unlike any child or adolescent impulse to make sense of who you are, to know your history, to know who you come from, where you come from, and what it means in a contemporary context of the world that we live in right now. I can remember being a child, and my parents had bought a collection of encyclopedias for my birth to sort of to commemorate my birth, and it was the World Book Encyclopedia from 1966, and
yeah.
I would read it all the time and remember coming across a section about races of man. And at this point, the encyclopedia still outlined Negroid, Caucasoid, Mongoloid.
Wow.
And it went so far as to talk about the different measurements, you know, from hip to knee and knee to ankle that you had if you were a different race.
As if these were carved in stone.
As if they were carved in stone. And, you know, my grandmother was a drapery seamstress, so all I had to do was sneak into her workroom and steal a tape measure and start measuring my thigh and then my shin to figure out which one I was.
What? Did you reach a conclusion or just a meditation on the measuring tape?
It was really more of a meditation, but I think that that's the kind of thing that set in motion my thinking about ideas about race and the way we often do think that they're set in stone.
No.
And yet we know that that's not quite the way it is.
And what about, I mean, the president in the end, you know, he moved to Chicago. I mean, we read recently how he had dated this way, dated that way. He finally sort of went to his African-American side for so much of his identity. What about you?
Well, what I'd like to say is that I actually don't believe it's as much of a choice mm-hmm. as people might want to believe.
Mm-hmm.
Having grown up in the Deep South, but also having traveled all around the country, I know that people are very open and optimistic, and yet we still maintain ideas about, you know, what was once called the one-drop rule, that if you have black blood, you are black. And it seemed to me growing up that the smartest thing to do for two reasons was to accept that idea. And for me, I didn't want to have the kind of wrestling with the self that prioritized one race over the other. Mm-hmm. It was more noble to go with the despised self. And of course, people always thought of me as black anyway. I always joke that you are what the cops say you are.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with the newly named U.S. Poet Laureate. She'll take up her duties this fall. Poet of history, of memory, Natasha Trethewey, professor of English and creative writing at Emory University, author of collections Native Guard, Belloc's Ophelia, Domestic Work. Her forthcoming poetry collection will be out this fall, Thrall, as in enthrall. You can read a selection of her poems at our website, onpointradio.org. Natasha, I wish you'd read for us, if you'd be good enough, and maybe introduce to us from your elegy for the Native Guards. It gives us a sense of the ways in which you've powerfully worked with history and memory and pulling strands to light. Could you introduce this poem for us a bit and then read it?
Yeah, sure. This is a poem that I wrote after visiting Ship Island, Mississippi, which is home to a Civil War fort, Fort Massachusetts. And what I was struck by is that I'd been going out to the fort my whole life with my grandmother on the 4th of July and never knew anything at that point about the fort's history beyond that it had been a place that Confederate soldiers were imprisoned by Union soldiers. What they didn't mention in the tour of the fort is that a lot of the soldiers there who were guarding Confederate soldiers were African-American Union soldiers. They were among the first officially sanctioned regiment of African-American soldiers in the Civil War, the 2nd Regiment of the Louisiana Native Guards.
Mm. And they were memorialized. You didn't even know about it, and many others either, I guess.
That's right. You know, once the book came out, I traveled around the state of Mississippi giving readings and, you know, would encounter people in college classrooms and in libraries and other places. And one of the questions that I would ask was first, how many people had been to Ship Island? Because mm-hmm. it's kind of a destination. People tend to go there on the coast. Mm-hmm. And all the hands would go up. And then I'd ask how many of them knew about the black soldiers who were stationed there. And almost all the hands would go down.
And not just their existence or their history, their record that they had been there, but in many ways over the years, you've tried to imagine what that experience must have been like. I mean, these were men, many of them who I guess had been slaves. Certainly they were Southern blacks who were now, you know, keeping guard over white Confederate soldiers. What a situation.
Well, I think it becomes a metaphor in some ways. I mean, we can look certainly at the fact of that and what seems almost unbelievable until it happens, but we can also look at it for the metaphor that it suggests, really that our histories are intertwined and overlapping, not two trains running on separate tracks, but really intersected in powerful ways. And who gets to tell the story of that has everything to do with what story will be told.
Tell us the story your way with your elegy for the Native Guards poem.
Yes. There's an epigraph that starts the poem from Alan Tate's Ode to the Confederate Dead that reads, "Now that the salt of their blood stiffens the saltier oblivion of the sea." Elegy for the Native Guards. We leave Gulfport at noon, gulls overhead trailing the boat, streamers, noisy fanfare, all the way to Ship Island. What we see first is the fort, its roof of grass a lee, half reminder of the men who served there, a weathered monument to some of the dead. Inside we follow the ranger, hurried though we are to get to the beach. He tells of graves lost in the gulf, the island split in half when Hurricane Camille hit, shows us casemates, cannons, the store that sells souvenirs, tokens of history long buried. The Daughters of the Confederacy has placed a plaque here at the fort's entrance, each Confederate soldier's name raised hard in bronze, no names carved for the Native Guards, 2nd Regiment, Union men, Black Phalanx. What is monument to their legacy? All the grave markers, all the crude headstones, water lost. Now fish dart among their bones, and we listen for what the waves intone. Only the fort remains, near 40 feet high, round, unfinished, half open to the sky, the elements, wind, rain, God's deliberate eye.
Natasha Trethewey, reading from her poem Elegy for the Native Guards. Those not noted on the monument, fish dart among their bones. She's the newly named Poet Laureate of the United States. Roger's calling from North Wilkesboro, North Carolina. Roger, you're on the air with the soon-to-be Poet Laureate. Thanks, Roger, you're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
How you doing?
Pretty well. What do you know?
Yes, I was wanting to speak to her about another location of a prisoner of war camp.
Mm-hmm.
It was at Point Lookout. Does she know anything about Point Lookout?
What kind of prisoner of war camp? Are we talking Civil War, Roger?
It was a Yankee prisoner of war camp, helped Confederate soldiers.
Is Point Lookout in North Carolina, Roger?
No, it's off the coast of Maryland.
Natasha, are you familiar?
No, I don't know anything about it. What can you tell me?
Roger, what can you tell us about it?
Well, my grandfather, he was in prison there, you know, I've researched it. I study Civil War is all I do, basically. I had a stroke in 2005, went blind. I get books from North Carolina for the Blind, and I just study Civil War and Revolutionary War.
And what do you take from the history of Point Lookout, Roger? What have you learned?
Well, I haven't never seen anything written on it. I'd love to see someone write. I did see one girl done her thesis. She went to college there in Maryland, and just luckily I just ran into her and asked her about Point Lookout. I'm always researching it, and she said, "I wrote my thesis on that." Mm. And it was black soldiers that was guarding the Point Lookout.
Oh wow!
There as well. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, I think that's important. I'm glad, Roger, that you called in to say that. Maybe someone out there will hear this and decide to do more work on those soldiers. When I first heard about the Louisiana Native Guards, it was also by accident. I was in a restaurant with my grandmother and talking about a project I wanted to do, and a woman was listening to us, and when she got up to leave, she said, "I think there's something else you need to know about Ship Island." And she mentioned these black soldiers, and I was hooked. I went straight to the Gulfport Public Library to try to find any information that I could. I think this was before James Hollinsworth's book about the Louisiana Native Guards, and all I could find was someone's MA thesis, and there was a small mention of the Native Guards in the thesis, and so I started, you know, doing research in the Library of Congress, and then later on, Hollinsworth's book came out, which was a great help to me, but it was one of those stories that we needed to hear, just like the one that you're mentioning.
You're so associated with poems of history. You have very current poems as well, and poems of memory, some deep memory, some from your own life. Where do you think we stand in terms of filling out the mural of American history and how it comes to mind these days, how full and true the picture that we carry in our minds is up against the reality of history at this point?
Well, that's what's very exciting to me about doing historical research and finding the music for it in poems. It is a mural, as you say, that we're trying to fill in. And if we were to look at it right now, we would certainly see lots of empty spaces. There'd be plenty of interesting and beautiful things there, but there'd be plenty of stuff that's missing. And I've been trying to, with my own interests, fill in some of those blanks. I do think that those blanks are going to require the work of a lot more people who come from a lot of different places across the country with a lot of different experiences to give us a fuller version of American history, one that isn't, narrow or only focusing on, from the top down, the sort of bottom up kind of histories that many historians are doing right now, really help to show us a larger cross section of American life and culture.
And when we get that fuller vision of American history, how do you think it changes the way we look at one another, understand one another now?
Well, I mean, I think it's the best thing that we have for changing how we look at one another now. I mean, the great thing about poetry is that, because it opens our hearts rather than closes them, it can matter to us because of its humane intelligence and the ability to tell us what we have not known and to show us what we've been blind to. It asks of us that we look at not only our own humanity, but the humanity of others. And across time and space, it reminds us of how we are alike, not that we are different. And I think by filling in that mural, we get to see what it is, the shared history that we have as Americans, but of course, across the globe as human beings.
Natasha Trethewey is the newly named Poet Laureate of the United States. Azikwe is calling from Charleston, South Carolina. Azikwe, thank you. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom and Natasha. Thanks for taking the call.
Yes.
I'm the new chair of the Charleston Remembrance Program, and we're part of a national and international movement to commemorate and pay tribute and homage to the millions of Africans who died in the Middle Passage, those who didn't survive the crossing from Africa to the Americas.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a program yesterday right here in Charleston, and we poured libations at noon, the same time that libations were being poured in Virginia, New York, California, Ghana, Panama, and a number of other ports. And so as part of the ceremony, I printed out the program, and I wanted to leave the attendees with a poem. And just as when you opened up the program saying we turn to poems when we're looking for something that we can't say ourselves and we want to say it succinctly.
Mm-hmm.
I ended up Googling Middle Passage poems, and I came across two that were a bit lengthy. One was a performance poem by Sonia Sanchez, and the other one was by Mr. Hayden, but it was like 3 pages long, so mm-hmm. I didn't use that one.
Mm-hmm.
So you were asking what we'd like to see from the Poet Laureate, mm-hmm. and I was just wondering if she's written anything on the Middle Passage, and if not, if that might be something, if she's heard of the remembrance programs, and whether or not that might be something she'd be interested in working on.
Azikwe, thank you. Natasha? Mm.
Oh, I think those remembrance programs are so important. And for me, it's because poetry acts as a kind of monument. And when we look at, places like Charleston or other places around the South and around the nation, one of the things that happens is that, monuments often tell only part of the story. Across the South, monuments to the Confederacy, for example, don't tell the full story of the struggle in the Deep South and the history of African Americans there. So it really is important to create these other kinds of monuments and to memorialize and create monuments in the living word of a poem. I've got a couple of really good friends who've written some wonderful poems about the Middle Passage. Elizabeth Alexander at Yale and my colleague Kevin Young here at Emory both have written tremendous poems, amazing poems. Of course, I know the poems that you mentioned also.
Mm-hmm.
I think that this is something that I would be interested in. I haven't written one myself, but it's only that I haven't been able to yet. You think of things that you'd love to address, and yet it often takes a long time before the right image, the right words, the right metaphor comes to you.
We'll wait for it. Azequa, thanks for your call. Could you read one more? This it's got more history here, but it's you got white and black this time. It's called Pilgrimage. It's got a Vicksburg, Mississippi sort of dateline on it. It goes back to the siege, I guess, of Vicksburg there when people hid in caves. Our time is short before the break, but maybe if you plunge right in, you'll get us to that heavy arm of history.
All right. Pilgrimage, Vicksburg, Mississippi. Here the Mississippi carved its mud-dark path, a graveyard for skeletons of sunken riverboats. Here the river changed its course, turning away from the city as one turns, forgetting from the past. The abandoned bluffs, land sloping up above the river's bend, where now the Yazoo fills the Mississippi's empty bed. Here the dead stand up in stone, white marble on Confederate Avenue. I stand on ground once hollowed by a web of caves. They must have seemed like catacombs in 1863 to the woman sitting in her parlor, candle lit, underground. I can see her listening to shells explode, writing herself into history, asking what is to become of all the living things in this place. This whole city is a grave. Every spring, pilgrimage, the living come to mingle with the dead, brush against their cold shoulders in the long hallways, listen all night to their silence and indifference, relive their dying on the green battlefield. At the museum, we marvel at their clothes, preserved under glass, so much smaller than our own, as if those who wore them were only children. We sleep in their beds, the old mansions hunkered on the bluffs, draped in flowers, funereal, a blur of petals against the river's gray. The brochure in my room calls this living history. The brass plate on the door reads Prissy's room. A window frames the river's crawl toward the gulf. In my dream, the ghost of history lies down beside me, rolls over, pins me beneath a heavy arm.
Natasha Trethewey reading from Pilgrimage. There. History, your inspiration, but also a kind of burden pinning you
absolutely
beneath its heavy arm. Oh, do you want to be free of that? Does it, the suggestion is let me up?
Well, you know, it is the burden of history. That is the essential metaphor, and yet it's a burden that I take on willingly. I sort of think of it the poet's duty as to record the cultural memory of a people. And so it is indeed a duty that I like taking on.
Who do you think lived in Prissy's room?
You know, it was on the third floor, so I think it had to have been the inside the house servants' quarters.
We think of it, I guess, because of Gone with the Wind. Every little piece weaves our sense of memory and name and who, what belonged to whom.
Right, and there's some tongue-in-cheek naming going on at the old mansion, because there's a General Sherman's room, too.
Oh. And that in Vicksburg.
That's the room I stayed in first before I felt, you know, that I wanted to move higher in the house. I thought I was being haunted on the first floor, and then it got even worse when I went up to the quarters.
Oh, boy, upstairs, downstairs. Natasha Trethewey is with us. She joins us from Atlanta. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour with the newly named Poet Laureate of the United States, poet of history, memory, Natasha Trethewey. She joins us today from Atlanta, Georgia. She teaches at Emory University there. White father, black mother, tragedy of her mother's murder, we'll look at that as well. And now a very exalted position in American poetry coming up. Let's go straight to Frances in Niagara Falls, New York. Frances, thank you for calling. You're on with Natasha Trethewey.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I have an interesting story. I don't know all the details, but my family on my father's side was kicked out of North Carolina because they couldn't be labeled as Negro or Caucasian. and they wound up in Ohio.
They couldn't be labeled because they were both or something?
Well, they had, from what I have heard, they were like, they had intermarried with Caucasian, the original, the Indians and the African, and for generations.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time my grandfather came along, they were so... have you heard of the Black Indian?
Natasha?
I've heard of, in North Carolina, some Indian tribes that are extremely mixed race, like what you're describing. I don't know if I've ever heard the phrase Black Indian.
Francis, you're a long way from there now. They ended up in Ohio, and you onto New York State.
Yeah, well, they spread all over the place. Mm-hmm. They a lot of them went out west. I mean, they were like kicked out. They were property owners and everything in North Carolina, and because they couldn't be labeled, they were just thrown out. I've heard.
They just didn't fit in a box. I appreciate your call, Francis. Natasha, maybe it's a place to look at race and place. I mean, you have a strong Southern upbringing, and you maintain that deep connection. Somewhere I read, you know, that in one of your poems, The Place I'll Be Buried, you write.
You know, that's true. But at the same time, I'm very interested in what Francis was talking about, because across time and space, people have had a need to try to label, to create taxonomies that put people in the proper, you know, if you will, boxes. My new book that's coming out in the fall is really all about that. It's about the kinds of taxonomies that in many ways come from the Enlightenment period of classification.
It was seen as an advance to classify and understand everything in that way.
Exactly. And there's a sequence in the book called Taxonomy, which is all about the Mexican Casta paintings. These are the paintings painted in colonial Mexico across the entire 18th century. And they showed the mixed blood unions that were taking place in the colony. So you'd see sort of the white Spaniard father and then the different blood mixtures that he would create, you know, by marrying different women. And they were done in series of 16, and you got the taxonomies of the people written right there on the painting. So you, for example, would have de Español y de India produce mestizo.
Mm-hmm.
De Español y
X plus Y equals Z.
De Negra, right, produce mulatto. And people who were born into that mixed blood category, the castas, were... their names were recorded in the Book of Castas. And so it was a way of creating a taxonomy and putting people in a particular box that helped to make sense to the people at the time of the place where they were living and the moment that they lived in. So I can imagine that, you know, Francis's story, though it might seem strange to us, is quite likely to have occurred, at least in some way, about the need to create those taxonomies.
Are you suggesting by that before the Enlightenment we weren't so boxed up in taxonomy and categorization? Is there some chance we're moving beyond it now? The Enlightenment's some distance behind us.
Well, that was the question that I was asking myself, and I don't say that I can give the answer. But in the book, what I try to do is to look back as far as I can to try to make sense of ideas about blood, the purity of blood versus the impurity of blood, something that would have to do with the Inquisition or, you know, language that has come down from us in the imagery of Renaissance paintings about religion. It's been going on, it seems, a long, long time. The language that we use to describe it has changed, and I think is changing still.
Nutria writes to us online, says your poetry is moving, liquid, mesmerizing, and says, please, please, please ask Professor Trethewey who her favorite historical poets are. So you're asked.
Well, thank you for that comment. One of them, of course, is Robert Penn Warren. I talk about
the first Warren, U.S. Poet Laureate.
That's right. That's right. You know, I talk about him a great deal. You know, he's the one that reminds me that historical sense and poetic sense should not be contradictory, you know, that they are really one in the same. And the work that we do to make sense of either of them is all about seeking truth. You know, the historians do that. Poets do that. I also really admire the work of Yeats and other Irish poets who deal with history, like Seamus Heaney and Evan Boland.
Mm-hmm. Seamus Heaney, who knows something about conflict in history and the importance of history. I saw in the announcement of your poet laureateness, Hood, is it true that you're the first Southern poet to be poet laureate of the United States since Robert Penn Warren?
Well, that's right. I mean, there were some Southerners who were consultants before the position changed to the title of Poet Laureate with Robert Penn Warren.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's a long stretch. Teresa in Moorefield, West Virginia. Teresa, thank you for calling. You're on with Natasha Trethewey.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi, Natasha.
Hello there.
My situation is I have a granddaughter who is biracial, and we are Caucasian. And my son married an African-American gal.
Okay.
And I have a granddaughter who's now 11. I just would like any pointers that you may have to help her to really assimilate both cultures and really just become the person that she's supposed to be herself.
Mm.
Oh, that's a deep grandmotherly question. You can hear how deep that question goes, Teresa.
And, you know, a fierce love is behind mm-hmm. asking such a question.
Yes.
And I let me think of, well, you know, anything that I would say would really sound kind of mushy, but I think that the question that you've asked is in many ways just the kind of thing that she might need, and that is knowing that on both sides of the family, she is deeply loved. I think that the thing that allowed me to grow up with, you know, not only a sense of purpose, but a sense of myself that wasn't always being beaten up with the perception that others might have of my status as a biracial person had everything to do with how much the people on my mother's side loved me and how much the people on my father's side loved me too.
Teresa, we wish you good luck with that and a good balance and way. What about your relationship with your parents going forward? Now, I know your mother's gone. She ended up being sadly murdered by a later husband, or at that point an ex-husband.
Yes.
How do you hold these two parents and the lives or worlds they represent in your own emotional life, sort of a horizon at this point, Natasha?
Well, it's a difficult thing to begin to grow older without one of the parents, and certainly
older than your mother ever.
That's right.
Became.
I you know, sometimes I think it's as if I'm living on borrowed time. Because I've been marking the ages that she was my whole life, since even before losing her. I think that was one of the reasons that I was drawn to a kind of historical sense, that I always sort of felt the weight of history marked by dates and other sort of events throughout my life. But living without my mother and sort of imagining who she might have become, you know, in her continued becoming. She was only 40 mm-hmm. when she died. It's hard to imagine a relationship with her now, and yet with my father, you know, I've continued to have. You know, we are sort of growing older together.
Mm-hmm.
My father, as I mentioned earlier, is also a poet, and so we have a relationship that is both father and daughter, but it's also writer to writer.
Mm-hmm.
And I cherish being able to have not only the conversation that is the private conversation between a parent and a child, but also in some ways the public conversation of father and daughter in poems that show the ways that personal and public history and memory are always linked, that there's a lens through which to look at the public history of of the United States and the world, and to look at my relationship with my father to make sense either way of either of those kinds of histories. The way history says something to me about my place in the world, and the way that my experience with my father actually speaks to a larger historical issue.
Maybe you could read for us from your new collection coming out later this year, Thrall. There's actually Elegy, and it begins, "For my father," something about the ruthlessness of the poet, perhaps, you note in the as we go into it, maybe for all of us, and maybe especially for our caller, Teresa, could you read?
Yes, I'd be happy to. Elegy for my father. I think by now the river must be thick with salmon. Late August, I imagine it as it was that morning, drizzle needling the surface, mist at the banks like a net settling around us, everything damp and shining. That morning, awkward and heavy in our hip waders, we stalked into the current and found our places, you upstream a few yards and out far deeper. You must remember how the river seeped in over your boots and you grew heavier with that defeat. All day I kept turning to watch you, how first you mimed our guide's casting, then cast your invisible line, slicing the sky between us. And later, rod in hand, how you tried again and again to find that perfect arc, flight of an insect skimming the river's surface. Perhaps you recall I cast my line and reeled in two small trout we could not keep. Because I had to release them, I confess I thought about the past, working the hooks loose, the fish writhing in my hands, each one slipping away before I could let go. I can tell you now that I tried to take it all in, record it for an elegy I'd write one day when the time came. Your daughter, I was that ruthless. What does it matter if I tell you I learned to be? You kept casting your line, and when it did not come back empty, it was tangled with mine. Some nights, dreaming, I step again into the small boat that carried us out and watch the bank receding, my back to where I know we are headed.
Natasha Trethewey reading from an elegy for her father from Thrall, comes out this fall, takes us into a very intimate relationship, father-daughter, parent-child. Is race a factor inside that father-daughter relationship? Is it beyond race? You've got experience not all of us have. How's that work?
Well, I think, sadly, it's not beyond race. I'd like to imagine a moment for anyone in the country, particularly, you know, people born of mixed race, where certain kinds of inherent ideas about racial difference don't somehow inadvertently make their way into our psyche. And yet, I don't think we're quite there yet.
Even in the intimacy of that, a parent, child, father, daughter, you know, even there, it's kind of distressing.
Well, I mean, it is, but it's one of those things that, you know, as Phil Levine has said, I write what is given me to write. And I think that I've been given to tell that story. Mm-hmm. What will help us understand a little bit more about how race operates in situations that are not intimate situations. That mm-hmm. it still happens in intimate situations is a thing that I think we all have to be concerned with. I mean, and this reminds me, of course, of the speech that President Obama gave, in which he was talking about his beloved grandmother, mm-hmm. and he talked about how fiercely she loved him, but nonetheless, and it was when he got to that word, nonetheless, that we have that sense that some ideas of difference still can exist even in the closest and most loving relationships that we have.
Wow. It's going to be very interesting to follow you, and particularly in your time as poet laureate. What do you want to do with it? We've seen Robert Pinsky and others have great public outreach. Billy Collins, we've talked with lots of poet laureates over the years. What do you hope is the trademark, the mark of your time?
Well, you know, I don't know yet, but I have to thank you for the question that you've posed to the listeners out there. I do hope to get lots of suggestions from the public about what they need from a poet laureate. I intend to spend the summer before my appointment begins thinking about how I might best bring poetry to a wider audience, what my mission should be.
Somehow we feel pretty confident you will bring a lot, and it's been a great talking with you this hour. We're going to go out with that song that got your mom and dad together.
All right.
A Little Righteous Brothers. Natasha Trethewey, author of Native Guard, Belloc's Ophelia, Domestic Work, Beyond Katrina. Look for Thrall this fall as she steps into the position of U.S. Poet Laureate. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, thank you as well. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
That love.